All rise. The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
The first case this morning is Agenda 7-1344, Syntona IP v. Pfizer. Ms. Stead, good morning.
Ms. Klein, may I approach? May it please the court. The district court committed multiple reversible errors and abuses of discretion below. As but one glaring example, the court entered judgment based on the irreconcilably inconsistent jury verdicts that the same process both anticipates under 102G but does not infringe the exact same claims of the 481 patent. Significantly, neither Pfizer nor the district court even suggests that these findings can be reconciled, because they can't. Instead, they both argue waiver based on an improper reading of controlling precedent, which is explained in our reply brief at pages 31 and 32.
You know, you list, as I counted, 13 issues for review.
Hmm? Yes, Your Honor.
I apologize to you, but I'm unable to keep in my mind 13 issues. Is it your view that all of these issues are of equal weight or non-weight, or is there one or two that you really think matter? And if so, could you tell me what you really care about in this case?
Sure. We really care about what I'd like to turn to first are the exceptional case finding and the finding of inequitable conduct.
So the rest of it is just sort of shotgun, hoping maybe you'll pick one of us off on some other side issue?
No, Your Honor. We also do think that those are all errors. And in fact, we think that the entry of a judgment based on irreconcilably inconsistent special verdicts can rise to a constitutional magnitude with respect to the Seventh Amendment right. And therefore,
the problem is that you've lost on multiple grounds and you have to act all.
Well, we would need to overturn the inequitable conduct finding. I agree. But with respect to judgment based
on...
Well,
you also have to overturn the validity finding if you want to preserve these particular claims that we're talking about.
Well, but I think under controlling Fourth Circuit and Supreme Court precedent, if you can't reconcile the verdicts, then the whole verdict gets lost.
No, I understand, but that's your argument. I mean, the reason you're raising so many issues is you lost on the conviction issues.
Yes, we did. Admittedly.
But they're not of all equal, not all of equal significance. Is that your view, or do you want to argue all 13?
We're not going to argue all 13 today in 15 minutes. In the limited time that I have today.
Do you maintain that every one of them rose to the outcome of the case? That you have to prevail on all of them in order to be on this case?
I don't think so. I think that in order.
Why do you bring it up?
I believe that maybe the listing of the 13 issues in the opening brief, some of them may have been actually duplicative.
Some may have been?
Duplicative.
Duplicative?
Yes.
Oh.
So I believe to overturn.
You're helping us by giving us lots of things. Forget it. Move on.
Sure. In the limited time I have today, I would like to focus on the grave errors in the district court's exceptional case findings and inequitable conduct. Permeating the district court's and Pfizer's inequitable conduct and exceptional case analyses are unfounded conspiracy theories. When viewed in light of Syntona's open-handed and extensive interactions with Pfizer relating to the very patents in suit, both during and after their prosecution and before this lawsuit was filed, those conspiracy theories disappear. This is not a case of Syntona BV surreptitiously copying Pfizer and then blindsiding it with a baseless infringement lawsuit in an attempt to extort money from Pfizer for Pfizer's work. This is a case where Syntona independently invented the subject matter of the patents in suit and threw out.
What's wrong with the inequitable conduct finding? The district court found that the lawyer who prosecuted these acted in good faith, if I recall. But his inequitable conduct finding relates to the guys who were the inventors and the people who were supervising them. So the fact that the prosecuting attorney tried to get information from Pfizer and behaved honestly was not, in the district court's view, a defense because of the conduct of the members and their supervisors. What's your response to that?
Well, I think there's several. I think with respect to Dr. Horn, he was not somebody that owed a duty of Rule 56 with respect to the prosecution of these patents. He was not an inventor. He was not substantively involved in the preparation of the prosecution of these patents. His only involvement was unknowing to him. He was listed erroneously as an inventor on the very first provisional application. He was never listed as an inventor on any of the succeeding non-provisional applications.
He didn't supervise or involve himself in all the invention?
No, he did not.
Really?
Yes. He signed some notebook entries of one of the inventors before that inventor actually worked on his invention. He was involved in the amlodipine project in general, and he was an inventor on other applications that were in that project. There were 8 provisional applications filed on the same day, and he was an inventor on one of those.
Well, we had a finding by the district court, finding fact, he was a supervisor, right?
He was, in certain points in time, he was a supervisor, but that does not mean that he was substantively involved.
He had a finding fact, right? Maybe wrong, maybe clearly erroneous, but we had a finding fact, don't we? That he was a supervisor within the meaning of the PTO rule.
Well, the PTO doesn't say that supervisors owe a Rule 56 duty. It says that folks that are substantively involved in the preparation or prosecution or who are inventors. Right. And he wasn't one of those.
But don't we have a finding of fact that he was substantively involved?
And that's erroneous.
Right. So that's what I'm asking you about.
Yes. We believe that that's an erroneous fact finding.
So if we disagree with you on that and we conclude that we should sustain that fact finding, where are we on the inequitable conduct?
I still think that there's no intent to deceive established even by Dr. Horn.
Because
there's no evidence that he intended to deceive the patent office. He wasn't attempting to obtain anything from the patent office. He wasn't involved in the prosecution. He didn't even know he was listed as an inventor, except for a meeting in February after the first provisional was filed, where he was made aware that he was listed as an inventor on this first provisional application, and it was clearly determined that he shouldn't have been. And then he was deleted as an inventor, or not included as an inventor in the next filing. And that was his only involvement in the prosecution.
Am I mistaken, but wasn't he just one of the people who had copies of these documents? Were there other copies?
I think it depends on which documents you're referring to. I think the district court glosses over and tries to paint everybody that was involved collectively with any document that's in the company's files. And that's not correct.
But there were other copies in the company's files.
In the company's files, but under controlling precedent, that's not sufficient to establish an intent to deceive on the part of a particular individual. Furthermore, I think when viewed in light of the context of the interactions between Pfizer and Synthon, it's clear that there would be no reason for withholding SDD or any other Pfizer prior art from the patent office. Specifically, starting in 2001, Pfizer and Synthon were involved in licensing negotiations related to Synthon IPs and amlodipine projects. And in fact, Pfizer purchased foreign rights to certain related amlodipine IP. And 3 months after the application that led directly to the 481 patent, yes, Your Honor? 3 months after they filed that application, they provided a copy of the application, which was confidential to Pfizer. And Pfizer subsequently, 5 months later, provided a copy, a 2-page excerpt of DIA, which is one of the recruiting brochures that Pfizer contends anticipates the 481 claims. Importantly, they didn't provide the entire publication, and they didn't even provide the second page, which would have included the copyright notice and a date. And for 3 to 4 years after obtaining that excerpt, Mr. Boucher and Synthon attempted to get any information that Pfizer would give them with respect to...
Because so what? I mean, suppose Pfizer was completely uncooperative. They have no obligation to be cooperative. How can that excuse inequitable conduct if they were uncooperative?
Well, I don't believe it excuses inequitable conduct. I do think that it makes their cries of that there's an injustice because they had to pay for attorney's fees in this litigation ring hollow. If they had provided information that DIA and SDD or SD to Mr. Boucher were available as prior art, and that was information that they had, that was readily accessible to them, that was difficult for anybody else to determine, then this lawsuit may not have been filed. In fact, Mr. Buescher attempted to obtain that information.
But the attorney's fees are based primarily on inequitable conduct before the patent office.
Not with respect to Synthon IP. The district court relies almost exclusively on litigation misconduct in bringing a baseless lawsuit. Because Synthon IP purchased the patents in suit from Synthon BV. Synthon IP was not aware of the inequitable conduct. In fact, Mr. Buescher was clear, completely absolved.
Can you tell me where the opinion says that? Because that's not my recollection.
I believe that's...
There is a reference in there to...
Maybe JA7.
There is a reference in there to baseless conduct. But I thought that with respect to the attorney's fees that Synthon IP did was basically that there was inequitable conduct and that they were responsible for the inequitable conduct of this affiliate.
I believe it's a footnote that bridges. I'm not sure if it's JA17. I can find that out and let me know during my rebuttal time, which I believe I'm cutting into. But I believe it's a footnote that bridges the pages because Mr. Buescher, who's now the president of Synthon IP, was absolved of any involvement in inequitable conduct, had no knowledge, had no reason to know of any inequitable conduct. And the court says, well, Synthon IP is not sufficiently removed from the inequitable conduct because of litigation misconduct, because they shouldn't have brought this lawsuit. However, Mr. Buescher, for months prior to filing the lawsuit, attempted to find out more information on DIA, even in 2005. And yet, immediately after filing the lawsuit, Pfizer knows who to contact in order to get information that DIA and this other recruiting brochure, SDD, are prior art.
Yeah,
and they don't get that information until the close of fact discovery.
I just don't remember the opinion. So if you can show me that the only way that 2008 was through the litigation misconduct, I appreciate
that. Okay, thank you. I'll do that.
Thank you. The central issue in this case, I think, is inequitable conduct.
Perhaps, but address first the invalidity claims, because it really does seem to me there's a problem. That there is an inconsistency between the non-infringement verdict and the invalidity verdict. At least just an anticipation.
No, I don't think there is, Your Honor.
How can they be reconciled? Because they're both based on what Pfizer is doing, right?
Well, they were both based on work of Pfizer, and the reason that I say that there, in my view, is not an inconsistency is because when you look at sandwich drug discoveries, for example, which is one of the grounds for 102 A and B invalidity holding, that's different than what was going on in Pfizer's plant. The question on infringement is, what was Pfizer doing in its plant? And the jury found and the judge upheld that Pfizer was not isolating the compound of Formula 3 in its commercial process in Barceloneta. That's one issue. When you get to the invalidity, the anticipation holdings, we're talking about something different, which is, here is a document that Pfizer published more than a year before the patent application. It describes generally the same process,
but
it doesn't. Because it doesn't give the general the details of what's going on in the plant. What it shows...
What detail is going on in the plant would help you to reconcile the verdicts?
The difference, and what I think reconciles the verdicts, is that the document simply shows a two-step process with the compound of Formula 3 standing alone. And their own inventor, Mr. Benecker, looking at that, said that that suggested isolation. What was going on in Pfizer's plant was different. What was going on in Pfizer's plant was something which left the compound of Formula 3 in a mixture with all of the other things from the crude reaction mixture so that only 40 to 60% of it was the compound of Formula 3. So there's something, there is a big difference between what's shown in a prior art document and the proof.
What's the big difference?
The difference is that the prior art document doesn't say 40 to 60% of what's in this box is the compound of Formula 3, whereas the evidence from what's going on in Pfizer's plant does show that.
Assuming there is an inconsistency between the infringement verdict and the anticipation verdict, would that also be true of invalidity based on obviousness?
No, I don't think so at all, Your Honor, because the testimony was very clear on obviousness that what Pfizer was doing was using a known method, applying it to a known compound, the compound of Formula 3, to come up with a known result. And that was what Dr. Ager, their own witness, testified to. So even if it wasn't anticipated, the evidence of obviousness, I think, is very plain. In fact, the only evidence was that it was obvious.
The obviousness testimony, in the sense I read that, and they say it's obvious to remove the solvent, which is not sufficient to satisfy the claim limitations under the district court's alternative claims of one. Is that not correct?
No,
that's what the testimony was?
I don't think that was the testimony, Your Honor, from Dr. Ager, from Synthon's expert. Synthon's expert testified, and our own expert, Dr. Bartlett, testified that isolation was a well-known chemical procedure, and that Dr. Ager testified that what was happening was simply the application of a known procedure,
he
isolation.
He did testify to that, but he was talking about a known procedure for removing the solvent, which does not satisfy the claim limitations under the interpretation of the claims that you were propounding. Isn't that correct?
No, I don't think that is correct. I don't think in the context in which he was asked that question that it was about solely about distillation. I think that the question to him was about isolation, and isolation.
Well, it was in general terms, but then he went on, and if you look at the citations from the one week of 58 to 60, he went on to talk to make clear, at least according to my reading, that in his view, something was isolated when the solvent was removed, which is a wrong construction, right?
Well, that was one of the ways of isolation. I don't think that Dr. Ager or Dr. Bartlett testified that distillation, in Dr. Ager's opinion, was the only way to isolate a chemical compound. It was just one of the ways that, in his opinion, you could do that. But there were other ways.
Distillation is removing only the solvent.
It is, in this context, is removing only the solvent. That's correct, Your Honor. But nevertheless, isolation, whether it, you know, no matter how you define it, was a well-known procedure. Isolating chemical compounds isn't new, and he was simply asked about isolation and testified that isolation of novanegal compounds, the type of compound we have here, was something that wasn't new, that hadn't been invented by Synthon, that other people had done before. And we put into evidence prior art patents, I believe the Sato patents and Sato papers, which showed isolation of novanegal compounds, and not talking about distillation, talking about actual isolation of those compounds.
If we were to uphold the district court's inequitable conduct position and perhaps the attorney's view, what would then be the proper disposition of the infringement and invalidity issues?
I think, based on what this court did in the Monsanto versus Bayer case and the Eastfeed case, both of them last year, that the court found that if it affirmed the inequitable conduct, it didn't have to get to any of the other issues because the patents were unenforceable. And I think that is the proper result here. There is no reason to go past that. And I would like to talk about the inequitable conduct for a couple of minutes, because Judge Ellis made express findings that Synthon's applicants copied what they knew was Pfizer's chemical route to make amlodipine, including the compound of Formula 3. He found expressly that they put that into a patent application. He had to find that they told the patent office that the compound of Formula 3 was new in their invention. And he found expressly that they withheld from the patent office every document in their files that showed that that wasn't true. And those findings were in a 39-page opinion based on evidence including that Synthon had the 1998 amlodipine page from Sandwich Drug Discoveries, which showed the compound of Formula 3, which showed Pfizer's chemical route. And it wasn't just Dr. Horn. It's Dr. Horn, Dr. Slimina, that Synthon, Dr. Horn, and Dr. Peters, and in fact, Dr. Peters' signature, Dr. Peters is a named inventor, is on one of these documents, that they wrote down in the summer of 1999, Pfizer's chemical route, including the compound of Formula 3, They wrote it down in two documents before they even started their work in the lab, before they did anything, and before they claimed to have invented the compound of Formula 3.
Well, the record seems to support much of what the trial judge found, but that still leaves the question of intent hanging out there. What's your view of the trial judge's intent?
And what the judge found was that not only that there was clear and convincing evidence of intent, he went farther and said that there was no reasonable doubt that the applicants and Dr. Horn intentionally failed to disclose to the patent office. And the basis for that was...
But Dr. Horn didn't have an obligation to disclose.
Well, I'll get to that in a minute, but if I can answer your intent question, the documents showed clearly, including, and I want to get on the intent question, the route according to Pfizer, Dr. Benneker had that, Dr. Horn had it, Dr. Slonina had it. And, you know, Dr. Benneker, I guess it's actually Mr. Benneker, he emailed it to Dr. Horn's assistant in the summer of 2000 while the patent application was being drafted. And then he claimed 4 months later that it was new and it was his invention. It said, route according to Pfizer. The intent element was based on these documents. It was based on internal Synthon documents which attributed this to Pfizer. There were three documents, the OPIN, which said it was based on a product folder from Pfizer, the DLOC, where Dr. Horn wrote in his notebook, should I put Route Pfizer in the DLOC? And then he did, including the reagents from Sandwich Dark Discovery and the other details, and Route according to Pfizer, which attributed it on its face to Pfizer. When Mr. Benneker gave that to Mr. Buescher, the attorney, he gave him the chemistry, he left off the route according to Pfizer part. Now, when you make an argument to the patent office that something is new in your invention, and you have at least three documents internally which say this was Pfizer's, and we knew it was Pfizer's, and two of them are dated before they even made their invention, I think the court is entitled to infer that there was intent there. But there's more than that, because we asked each of these witnesses, what's the explanation? How did you write this document? How did you write this down? Where did this come from? Not a single person had an answer. I don't recall, I don't know. Those were the two things. People who signed, inventors who signed documents before they made the invention, showing the compound of Formula 3, and not having any explanation other than, I don't remember this document. And Judge Ellis, as he was entitled to do and rightfully did, found that that testimony wasn't credible. And when someone writes something down in a document that's totally inconsistent with what they tell the patent office, and then all it says, don't know, don't remember, I think there's full case support for finding that there was intent to deceive. I don't know what more intent to deceive you could have had other than a person coming in and saying, yes, I intended to deceive. And the testimony totally inconsistent with the documents. On the Dr. Horn question that you asked, Dr. Horn was someone who, as Judge Light pointed out, Judge Ellis found specifically was substantively involved in the patent prosecution. He was a named inventor on the provisional. The first time that a different group of inventors was named was in January of 2002 after there were two continuations, but he was head of the project. Three of the four inventors reported to him. He did literature searches for the inventors. He reviewed the patent search reports, and I think most importantly, to say he wasn't substantively involved when the record is clear that in early 2001, the attorney, Mr. Buescher, had telephone conversations with the entire group, with Dr. Peters, with Mr. Benneker, with Dr. Horn, and the others, to talk to them about the patent application, to go through the claims with them, to find out who the inventors were. And he, in fact, told Dr. Horn that he had a duty of candor and that he had to disclose anything that was material. But putting all of that aside, even if Dr. Horn didn't have a duty, I think there's certainly not a clearly erroneous factual finding on that. That doesn't get around Mr. Benneker and Dr. Peters telling the patent office that the compound of Formula 3 was new and their invention when each of them knew that wasn't correct. Because Dr. Peters signed a document in the summer of 1999 that showed it wasn't correct, and because Mr. Benneker had on his computer route according to Pfizer, which showed it wasn't correct, and there's no explanation for that. I have only one other thing that counsel said that I'd like to respond to, and that is The suggestion here on exceptional case that there were open dealings between Pfizer and Synthon. And if Pfizer had just told us these things, maybe there wouldn't have been litigation. Well, the things that were the basis for the inequitable conduct, that Synthon had sandwich drug discoveries, that Synthon had the OPIM, that Synthon had the VLOC, that Synthon had, according to Pfizer, Pfizer didn't know any of that. In fact, Synthon, without telling Pfizer that, was trying to get Pfizer to pay them a lot of money for this patent application without telling them any of that. So the notion that this was an open process and, oh, we were telling Pfizer everything, just doesn't work.
And is the attorney's fees award based on the inequitable conduct, or is it based on frivolous litigation?
It was based on both, Your Honor, and I think the little order on that makes it clear that the judge first goes into inequitable conduct and says this would be an exceptional case based solely on inequitable conduct. But he then does find litigation misconduct, and I think that's an interesting point, because when Mr. Buescher testified that he learned about...
What's the page? Is that it? The district court's finding about the defendant's case.
I believe it's at Joint Appendix 63. But on the litigation misconduct, if I can just finish that up, Mr. Buescher testified, this is Joint Appendix 1780, that by the summer of 2005, he knew about sandwich drug discoveries and the related documents in Synthon's files. When we went to them after we found out about them in the litigation and we said, drop the case, they said, no, we're going to seek hundreds of millions of dollars and an injunction from you. And that's at Joint Appendix 6330-32. And I'm down to 9 seconds, but that's all I had to say anyway, unless there are other questions.
I have one quick question. This is there was not a jury, a general jury verdict, right? This is a 49A case rather than a 49B case.
I believe that this was a special verdict because there was not just a who wins, who loses.
Yeah, so it's 49A.
I don't have the rule numbers in mind, but I think
that's right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly, the portion of the joint appendix that relates to the exceptional case finding is at JA 62-64.
Yeah, and then on 62, the judge says Synthon's inequitable conduct before the PPO is alone sufficient to compel him to win this case exception.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the party that was found guilty of inequitable conduct was Synthon BV, which is not the plaintiff in this lawsuit. The plaintiff in this lawsuit is Synthon IP, who purchased the patents for good and valuable consideration. And in addressing why Synthon IP should be held accountable for Pfizer's attorney's fees, because Synthon BV is not paying for those fees. That would be coming directly from Synthon IP. The court says it's because they brought what they should have known was a baseless litigation. And we think that that's clearly erroneous. That there was no way that Mr. Buescher and Synthon IP could have known about this information, or should have known, or that this lawsuit was baseless. With respect to the inconsistent verdicts, I'd just like to point out that if you find that there's irreconcilably inconsistent special verdicts, you're not free to just go in and pick it. The district court's not free to just go in and pick and choose which of those special findings to give weight to. In fact, you must throw out the whole verdict, and you can't enter judgment based on that. That's error, and the precedent that controls that is Ladner v. Murray from the Fourth Circuit, as well as Gallup v. B&O Railroad, 1963 case from the U.S. Supreme Court. And those are cited in our reply brief, I believe at pages 31 and 32.
Ms. Stafford, I was struck, as was Judge Ellis, with regard to a point on Mr. Blumenfeld, that your witnesses never had any explanation for how these documents ended up in the files and all of that. Is that a correct reading of the record, that there was never any explanation?
I think it's an oversimplification. It's based on lumping all the individuals together, just as opposing counsel just did. For example, he said that they wrote it down that Pfizer had created.
Did any of them have an explanation?
Well, Dr. Beneker never saw and testified he never saw DLOC, he never saw OPIM. the route Pfizer, he didn't recall it, but that document was dated 10 months after his conception.
The question is not of the sort. The question is, did anybody offer an explanation? Is Judge Ellis correct that nobody offered an explanation for these documents in your files?
Well, I think it depends on an explanation of what. I mean, Dr. Menaker testified he never saw those documents, so how could he explain why he didn't provide it to the patent office? He didn't see it, so he couldn't have provided it. Dr. Slonina only saw an undated excerpt of SDD, and it was after, six or seven months after, he'd been informed that Dr. Menaker had invented this two-step process. So he had no reason to know that this was something that would have related to Pfizer's work before Dr. Menaker's invention or not. That leaves Dr. Peters. And the three documents I'd like to walk through is first the DLOC document. That was not authored by Dr. Peters. It was not authored by Dr. Horn. It was not authored by any of the inventors. It was not found in any of the inventors' files. And Dr. Peters testified that he didn't recall ever seeing it. It's a draft. It was never signed. It was never approved. And it does not attribute the synthetic route in that document to Pfizer. Never mentions it. With respect to OPIM, that was a document that was created primarily to help obtain regulatory approval at a time when Synthon was not interested in actually making amlodipine, but was interested in actually purchasing it, and therefore was studying impurities and metabolites. It was not found in any of the inventors' files. It was not a widely circulated document that was used by the research and development team. And Dr. Peters recalled that he must have signed it, but he surely doesn't recall ever reviewing it. He never saw SDB, and SDB was never found in his files.
Thank you.
Thank you.